And that's when Vicini really goes hard in on these two, because they've both kind of challenged his authority in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And Vicini reminds me of like someone who bought a Subway franchise and thinks that they're like hot to trot. What? Welcome to Platters to this month's podcast. I'm Lydia Malcolm.
I'm Jen McQuaid.
And I'm Naomi McQuaid. And you know what movie we're about to talk about? Because you just clicked on the thing. You mother freaking guys. We're about to mess with your brain holes because we're about to review / exposit on, freak out about, rejoice, and probably less than usual, malign, The Princess Bride. You are so excited. You were like, either I'm starting here or I'm continuing here. This movie has affected me.
It is probably our most popular movie that we've reviewed so far, isn't it?
Well, everybody I've told about it. And mind you, we really don't tell people what movie we're reviewing because we want to keep it fresh for the podcast. But everyone I've been like, well, it just so happens to the handful of people that I've talked to, they've been like, you're doing what? And I can't blame them because it's such a milestone for all of us.
I don't know a person who hasn't actually seen this movie and just been like, this is a great movie.
100%.
Super quotable.
Super watchable.
Super enjoyable.
Yeah. Well, Lydia was mentioning during our viewing that like it's aged so well, you know? So we'll probably launch in. We got to start with our starting points and maybe talk a few Sean facts before we jump into the plot. But I mean, it ain't going to be hard. This movie came out in 87. So I was officially maybe 4 years old. Mm-hmm. And I mean, again, because I was so young, always part of my life. Came out the same year, Sean fact. Nope. Jen fact. That it came out the same year as Brave Little Toaster, which is a problematic film I've seen several times, but probably fewer times than I've seen this film. And I love this film so, so very, very much. So that's where I got it. We just watched it on VHS all the time. Like if we were going to watch a fantasy film, this was the one.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't have a really great lead in, but certainly watching it later on in life, I mean, it came back full force in my late teens, early 20s. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like if people ask me about a romance film that I like, this is basically it, even though it's not like your classic rom-com. So
right.
That's where I'm at. Lids, where'd you come in?
Oh, this has probably just been a staple in growing up. Kind of like, you know, with The NeverEnding Story, it was just always there on network television. You know, certain parts edited out, certain words maybe edited out. But it was so minuscule and it was so like inconsequential to the plot itself that it was really hard to go ahead and like, if you took those things out, it was going to, you know, stop the entire plot going through. So it was like, oh yeah, this is on. It's something that I can watch. You know, I'm gonna watch it because it's fully enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What about you, Jen?
I actually got the privilege of seeing this in the theater.
Shut your face.
Yeah, I was about 6 years old, and I remember seeing it as a double feature. And for the life of me, I can't remember what the first movie was. Just the second movie, which was Princess Bride. But I think it was probably Three Men and a Baby.
Oh, well, that's worth forgetting as far as I'm concerned.
But I remember staying up way past my bedtime to watch this with my family. So there were parts of it that I fell asleep to. I didn't get to watch and fully enjoy the entirety of this movie until it was on VHS.
Man. Do you remember? Okay, so you've been privy to the Sean facts. Do you remember how much this movie was made for?
I do. The budget was $16 million. And can you guess how much it grossed?
I did read the Sean facts, and now that you mentioned that much, I remember noting to myself that it made $30.9 million, and nearly double is pretty okay.
$30.8, you're pretty close there, yes.
Nitpicker.
I'm only nitpicking because, you know, Sean's going to come back in shock talk and say, well, Naomi actually said that it was $30.9 million, but it was $30.8 million.
You guys, applauders, I hope you listened to, if you listened to Return to Oz and then you heard the shock talk about it, I hope you thoroughly enjoyed Sean and Maddie's bantering about it because it's pretty stinking cute. And we hope to have them back again at the end of this film. So that'll be week 4. or week five of this podcast, depending how long it takes for us to unravel the joy that is Princess Bride.
And we certainly hope to hear your feedback. You can email us at shockedandapplaud@gmail.com. You can tweet us at shockedapplaud and visit our Facebook at shockedandapplaud. Any of those are great ways to message us and let us know your feedback on how we continue to develop this great program.
Plus also, just as a side note, and I know this is like totally, we should launch into the movie in like less than 15 seconds, but if you have a podcast and you listen to our podcast, let's share our promos during Craft Services Table, which is a special little extra blurb we put out once a month or so, just so that you know that we're listening to you and we want you to listen to us and that we want to share you with the people who share us and dot, dot, dot.
So we're currently doing that 3 times a month. And we're doing it one show at a time. That's our current way to do our segments for Craft Services Table. That may change in the future, depending on what our listenership really looks like. But if you have a podcast and you want to promo us, please do let us know. You can send those promos to our email, and we will definitely thank you for that and hopefully include you in the future.
Was that shockedandapplaud@gmail.com?
That was shockedandapplaud@gmail.com.
Lydia, did you get that?
shockedandapplaud@gmail.com?
Yes, it was.
A few more production-related or award-related notes before we dive directly into the plot. This was number 50 on Bravo's 100 Funniest Movies, number 88 on the American Film Institute's AFI's 100 Years, 100 Passions Film Love Stories, number 46 in Channel 4's 50 Greatest Comedy Film List. In 2016, the film was inducted into the National Film Registry, being deemed as culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant, and it also won the 88 Hugo Award for Best Dramatic Presentation.
Those sound like Sean facts.
Definitely a list and bulleted out as best as I could so that we could continue on without having to go too much into fact-related stuff and
If you love a Sean fact, you'll love Shock Talk.
Mm-hmm.
True.
So, let's lean on Lydia's notes, because mine are near non-existent, but I do have so many opinions about this film.
Yes. So this is one of those films where I could probably, at first I was like, maybe I don't need to take notes. And then like halfway through, I was like, maybe I should just like get the script and work my notes around the script, because the script is so quotable.
Yes. And because William Goldberg, who wrote the script, also wrote the screenplay, everything quotable from the book is in the movie. Everything quotable from the movie is in the book. Shout out, and I will tag you in this post, and I'm very sorry, but Joseph Dillman, I stole your copy about 12 years ago.
She still has it.
I'm looking at it right now. I've taped it back together a couple times. If you need it back, I will send it to you, but it is a part of my life right now, and I just want you to know that it's part of what brought us to this moment right here, right now.
And I'd just like to add that the author is William Goldman, not William Goldberg.
Goldberg. Sorry, I've done that for years. I'm actually looking at the Goldman. I'm looking at the... Okay, I'll put a picture on our Facebook, but the cover's pretty worn out. It looks not legible. The author isn't legible on the cover anymore.
There were several attempts to make this movie. 1973 was the year that it was published, as well as the first time that a screenplay was written. And 20th Century Fox paid Goldman $500,000 for the film rights. But due to the head of production at Fox being fired, the project was put on hiatus.
He bought his own rights back.
He bought the rights back to the film with his own money.
Mm-hmm.
And other directors had also tried to pick up the book, including Francois Truffaut, Robert Redford, and Norman Jewison. And at one point, Christopher Reeve was interested in playing Wesley.
Could you imagine Christopher Reeves as Wesley? That's, I mean, like
Superman.
I could, kind of.
Mm-hmm. So is that a Sean fact?
All that's definitely not out of my brain at all.
Yeah.
All right. So going into the movie, something that is a staple, like I said, there's a lot of things that are quotable in this movie. But one of those is always the coughing kid at the beginning. And then it goes into the... And then we see this, like, I mean, for something called The Princess Bride, it opening on a video game of, specifically a sports video game, by the way.
Yeah, it's Atari 64. It is...
Commodore 64.
I meant Commodore 64, which is what my grandparents had. Didn't that have the Muhammad Ali punching boxing game on it?
Maybe.
Or was that Atari?
Are you talking about Mike Tyson's Punch-Out? Because that was NES.
No, I'm talking about an older version of some sort of boxing game.
There was a boxing game. It was probably called Boxing. That was on the Atari.
That's what I played at Grandma's house on the floor in front of her giant box TV that had the record players in it.
Oh.
This game
specifically. Me and Lydia have both dusted that record player. It is a whole thing.
This game specifically was Hardball, and it was most popular on the Commodore 64, but it may have been on the Atari. But the theme song that you're hearing actually isn't part of that game. It was introduced into the film as part of the game, but it wasn't.
Yeah, it was a post-production add-on, which is fine because we see this, like, you look at it now and you're like, that's pixely and super janky, right? And then it pans over, right? Maybe not pans over, but it cuts over to, does it go straight to Fred's face?
Yeah, I think you see the camera cut and it's Fred Savage playing this kid who's just like, oh, I'm totally trying to, like, you know, get to this first base playing this sports video game.
Now, did they do the knock at the door after that?
I think so. And his mom walks in.
He's like, I'm just sick.
Mm-hmm.
First case of COVID.
Oh, what a time to be alive.
This is November, Jen. COVID's been over for weeks.
Grandpa doesn't come in with a mask or anything like that.
Oh, they mentioned masks later on and it killed me. Do you remember that?
Like I said, this movie has a lot of like standing power even to this day.
Oh my God. Okay.
But the mom comes in and she like feels his forehead and makes sure that, you know, oh, you're still sick and everything. Mm-hmm. And she goes and opens up the windows and you can see Christmas decorations on trees and snow falling.
He has like the creepiest Santa Claus cutout. That Santa Claus looks like he's Gungam styling behind him, but with like the maddest face. He's like, Oompa Christmas style. And whenever they cut back to the bedroom and they look at the grandpa, spoilers alert for the next 30 seconds,
yeah,
this Oompa grandpa is behind him.
It's like framed between the grandson and the grandpa.
Yeah,
it's really
just like,
weird.
Mm.
Yeah. So basically the mom comes in and says, hey, your grandpa came to see you. And is like, why does he always come to see me? He always pinches my cheek. And he's like, well, it's because you're sick. And I was like,
I remember when people could visit you while you were sick.
Mm-hmm.
Grandpa walks into the bedroom. He is played by
Peter Falk. And his entrance is just like, hey.
He's like everybody's grandpa.
Yes.
He's got a fedora type hat on, a floppy fedora type hat. And he's just like, I'm here to read you a story.
Yeah.
And Fred is like,
Yeah, you're like, oh, I brought you a present. And Fred Savage like hungrily opens it up in the way that only a kid can do. And then he's like, it's a book.
My father read it to me. I read it to your father. And now I'm here to read it to you.
Yeah.
Back in my day, television was called books.
Right? When I was sick, I sat in this very basement and binged like whatever came on the TV.
Mm-hmm.
There was no choice.
Mm-hmm.
Back in my day, internet was called television.
Back in my day, cell phones were called go yourself.
So what you're saying is that if there was ever a remake for like post 2020, you're going to have a grandfather being like, okay, we're going to sit down and we're going to watch this movie. Back in my day,
that's
the internet was called TV.
I watched this movie with my father and I'm watching this movie with your father and I'm going to watch this movie with you. Hold on. And then you just blow off the DVD player like...
And the kid says something about like, I'm pretty sure you could get this on like iTunes.
If you paid like $1.99, you could get it on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you just have your Disney Plus subscription.
Truth.
Yeah.
This is our second Disney Plus film in a row.
This is our third Disney film then?
Mm-hmm.
We should really lay off the Disney next time.
Though you won't find Howl's Moving Castle on Disney Plus. You'll only find that on HBO Max.
Correct.
Oh, fair.
Anyway, so he pops open this book and it's called The Princess Bride by...
Oh, by the way, the mom nopes right out of there.
Yeah, she does. Because she's like probably had it with her like preteen son.
Who's materialistic and a little douchey. Judgment. Come at me, bro.
I'm just saying, like, if I've been dealing with like a preteen boy who has been kind of under the weather for the last week.
Aww.
Not COVID, by the way.
Well, I would like to note that Fred Savage specifically always sounds sick. Like, there's something about his voice where he's always kind of just
talking. Like this guy. I can't. When am I going to get to hook up with Winifred?
Yeah. Even in the Deadpool, Deadpool 2.5.
Yes, that was a Sean Peck too, but when he reminded us, I was like, oh my God. I remember, because I love Deadpool so much that when Deadpool 2 came out, I went and I saw that too. And I was like, what is happening?
That movie was specifically a test for demographics to see if they could move Deadpool as a 20th century product into the Disney lineup.
Did it work?
I don't know. Did you see it? Did you see Deadpool 2.5?
Yeah.
I mean, I saw it. I saw Deadpool 2. I didn't see Deadpool 2.5, so.
Applauders, we're 1.5 minutes into the plot of this movie, and we are in episode 5. It's part 5 of this episode, which is our 19th episode. And I just want to thank you for staying with us this long. Okay. So he starts reading the story, right?
Right.
Here's where we're at.
Sorry, I'm looking at my notes because apparently I'm the only one.
No, you are. I could read you the book. Okay. I could read you the book.
No, no, don't. So he starts reading and he says, you know, Butter, and he talks about, like, you know, in the country of Florin, there was a girl named Buttercup and her only joy was tormenting the farm boy named Wesley. Isn't that wonderful? And you hear in voiceover Fred Savage go, yes. He's so begrudging.
Yes, he's only placating his grandpa and it's delightful.
My second note was Darren. Scruffy farm boy hair still makes me warm. Because this is Wesley, played by, what is that? It was the post-Jigsaw movie, Cary Elwes.
Right. Okay. Yeah. We're talking about like 20-something Cary Elwes, whom, here's the thing. When I was young, I never heard celebrities' names out loud. So I called him Cary Ewles for at least 2 decades until somebody was like, hey, did you watch Jigsaw with like, or, you know, whatever the other ones are called? The other ones are called. They're like, Cary Ewles. Or...
Yeah.
And I'm like, wait, what?
Is it Ewles?
Cary Elwes.
Elwes. That's how I've always heard it. So
I thought it was Ewles. Then.
Yeah. Yeah. It can be really hard to know what someone's name says pre-internet.
Well, here's the thing. Guess, okay, Ariana...
Grande?
Grande.
Grande?
Yeah. She says it like that, and we all say it wrong.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of them like that.
Yeah.
I'm just throwing it out there. Yeah. Listen to a celebrity pronounce their own name, and then go from there.
Do you know who Donal Gleason is?
Donal.
That's how he says it. Like, I looked it up one day because I saw it on some Tumblr post where he was like, please just say my name correctly if you're going to be interviewing me.
We all call it Donald.
Donal, yeah. But it's Donal. Because he's Irish.
Oh.
Yeah. So there's a specific pronunciation. And as someone who constantly gets like, whose name constantly gets replaced with Linda, and I'm like, where's the N? I totally am like, yeah. Okay, I'm going to say your name correctly from now on.
Yeah, it means something to you.
But anyways, back to the movie instead of talking about celebrity pronunciations of names.
Okay, so we got Buttercup, farm girl, farm boy. Okay, so she is like, in the book, right? She reaches the most beautiful woman in the world status, which is why she's noticed, right? But in the movie, they never explain why she's so very, very special. But that's what makes the movie better, because although that part is kind of cute in the book, in the movie, they just fall in love. She enjoyed riding her horse. She enjoyed ordering out around the farm boy. And every time she told him to do something, he would say,
as you wish.
I've always wanted Jen to say it.
Why?
I know where you sleep, Jen. 1, 2, like... Give a girl her fantasies. And 3, I did spend a number of months trying to train you to say it.
Train?
Not ashamed. I'm a behaviorist at heart. I wanted you to say as you wish whenever I asked you to do something because of this movie. Because it wasn't like I was making you do all these odious tasks for me. You'd be like, oh, I want to do this for you because I love you.
Be a simp for me. As you wish.
Thank you. That's my new ringtone. I'm so sorry. But yes, it's one of the greatest phrases of all time. We don't use it nearly as much as any other of the other quotable lines in this movie. It's just that thing that's glorious because he's such a simple and earnest character for the whole first few scenes of this film. He's just this simple character who just has these piercing eyes and this windswept hair and this kind of ugly mustache that we look past.
He doesn't even have the mustache at this point. Oh, he grows the mustache for Dread
Pirate.
He doesn't.
Shh, spoilers.
But there is this. Okay, so whenever you're creating a character, you're supposed to like give them a very specific want or a need. And that kind of like makes it relatable to the audience, or it can make it more relatable to the audience. And so for like in this first scene, we see Buttercup played by Robin Wright.
Amazing.
And
it's like, and the credits say introducing Robin Wright. Mm-hmm. Like,
and she is completely oblivious for like the first half of the scene.
Yes.
And, but he has a very clear goal. He loves her and he's like, yes, I will do whatever you want me to do.
And then he says, as you wish. What he was saying was, I love you.
And when she recognized it, that's when she knew she loved him back. And so it flips. And you actually have more character growth with Buttercup in the first scene.
I'm going to say that is exactly right. The second she goes, farm boy, and he turns around and she's like, oh, I need something for him to do. So farm boy, fetch me that pitcher that's right above her head. And he comes over. Oh my God. When he reaches over her head and plucks the pitcher from the ceiling, and he's just like, he brings it down all like, in my head, it all goes slow-mo. And he's just like, as you wish. A like little kid me didn't need anything else in the movie. If it had shut off, oh, I don't know, Quibi style in that moment, I would have been fine with it.
Yeah. And then we're told that he has to go and get his fortune in order to, you know, stay with Buttercup for some reason.
I don't remember every part of the book, but in the book, he goes to America to set up a life for them so that they can live in as man and wife together. But in the movie, they just say over the seas to the land across the sea, not like Gilder, which is across some body of water, but across the sea, vague style.
Wow, I would not have expected that there would be an America to go to in the time that this movie was supposed to take place.
So, fun fact, America is less than 300 years old. In the book, nope, in the movie at least. I can't remember if in the book. But in the movie, there Florence is about to experience its 500-year anniversary. So it's just out of luck if you're going to go to America, you've got to wait another 200 years. It's so dumb. Okay. So anyways, so we went. Okay. This is this exposition, right? The narration tends to lend itself to exposition. This movie does exposit within the script itself, but the grandpa moves things along quickly for us for a lot of the plot line of the book. And so the grandpa's like, he goes over the seas to make his fortune, and he gets captured by Dread Pirate Roberts, and he dies. and then Buttercup locks herself in the room for like
ever
90 days or something. And it's just like, they cut to her face as she stares off tearfully in the distance, and she goes, I will never live again. And then he goes, 5 years later.
Well, we did miss one of the best parts that really brings you back in. Okay. And makes you know that this is like the story between the grandson and the grandfather is like framing the story.
Yes.
And it was because Buttercup and Wesley start kissing. And what does Fred Savage do?
Grandpa, is this a kissing book? which okay, my anti-romance movie ass is like, I really hate romance movies. Please don't make me watch a romance movie. But this one doesn't count.
Right.
Because of exactly what the grandpa says probably two scenes ago. He's just like, there's sword fighting and there's death and there's poisoning. And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's do all of those things and don't make me think, oh, we love each other so much and blah, blah, blah. I want you to choose me. Rain pouring down.
Yeah.
Did you write me every day? Me misquoting The Notebook because that movie. But do you think we'll ever do The Notebook or something as terrible?
I would almost say, like, if we had to choose one romance, it would probably be like either Return to Me or While You Were Sleeping. Return to Me has Minnie Driver and David Duchovny. And it's the one where the like guy's wife dies and her heart goes into Minnie Driver. And then like the guy and Minnie Driver get together.
Gross.
Yeah, but then there's While You Were Sleeping, which has Bill Pullman and Sandra Bullock.
Let me hijack your life while you were unconscious. No!
Those are the only two that I'm halfway interested in doing. So if we don't do those, I'm okay.
I want to pick something super terrible and do like Twilight.
Okay. Just the first movie, though.
Or we could do something even worse than do like 50 Shades.
What if we did like one of like, what if we did like the gender reversal of Twilight where it's from Edward's point of view?
No.
They have that book. Well, it's not a movie. It would be the book. Anyways, not the point. We don't have to do a romance. Like, what about Dirty Dancing? We don't have to do Dirty Dancing. We don't have to. This could be the closest.
Every school dance I ever went to, and every time the ladies at work have on the Smooth Rock video, radio station on, and it's just like, when the radio starts, and I'm like sitting there, I'm at a machine, and I'm cutting paper, and it's like, I had the time of my life. I'm like, chop the paper, slice it in twain.
Interesting fact, Dirty Dancing, I believe, came out the same year.
No! No!
The most 80s movies that tried to do the 50s.
I want to put that baby in a corner so bad and then set that corner on fire.
So, back to the movie.
Yeah!
We have Peter Falk's character, the grandfather, says, isn't that terrible? And you hear Fred Savage say, yeah, that's really... No. He says, murdered by pirates is good.
Yes, Fred says, murdered by pirates is good. And then she locks herself in the room. I will never love again. 5 years later, now the king and the queen step out onto a balcony. Humperdinck, and the king kind of waves everybody off. Humperdinck comes out and he's just like, 10 days from now, I'm going to marry a commoner, not unlike yourselves, but perhaps you won't find her as common now. I present to you Princess Buttercup.
And who should come out but Buttercup in this beautiful princess gown? Before he asks that, before he announces her coming out, he's like, would you like to meet her? And everybody at the same time says, yes!
They don't say yeah or cheer. Oh, yeah. They're like, yes.
There was a guess.
Affirmative. Correct, overlord. Oh, my gosh.
My note was peasants in unison because they all do it at the same time. And this was the first moment that every time I watch it, it reminds me of how comedic this whole movie is, because that's just kind of hilarious.
Well, Rob Reiner has a fantastic sense of comedic beat. Like, I can't remember something that was supposed to be funny that wasn't funny. If you tend to find humor in a situation, generally, I find like the people who direct that sort of thing can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like Sam Raimi.
Yeah.
Sean, fact, we already know that Buttercup is this sort of peasant girl. So why is it called the Princess Bride? Do either of you know?
I know, because I read the Sean facts.
I didn't read the Sean facts, so let me go ahead and postulate. I think that it's called the Princess Bride. I'm putting my hands on my hips, plotters.
Do it.
I think it's called the Princess Bride because she gets shifted up to the status of princess and she's a bride. Okay, never mind. That's probably wrong.
Actually not totally wrong.
Okay.
So in the book, Sean fact, because it's been a while since I've read the book, Prince Humperdinck creates a fake country and makes her the official princess of it because she has to be a princess so they can get engaged.
But he announces it in the movie as though she was a peasant. So yeah. How does he justify it?
Well,
he just like say, oh, guess what? She was a long lost princess and this is a royal lineage and blah, blah,
well,
blah.
Well, here's the thing. The Princess and the Frog. The only reason. Do you remember The Princess and the Frog?
The Disney version or the generic or the general fair?
The Disney version.
OK. Yeah. So
they stay a frog until they get married and they kiss, at which point she becomes a princess.
Mm-hmm.
And he's officially kissed a princess. And so they both turn back into human beings.
Oh, OK.
Post fact, spoiler alert. So the opposite kind of happens here. He just makes her a princess so they can get married.
I like to think that if he had to kiss her, she's just sort of like, you can kiss my hand.
He doesn't kiss. His lips don't part like that. He only knows how to...
He's like a fish? Sorry.
No, I was going to be way grosser than that, so I'm glad you kind of saved it. Okay. With a fish comment.
It's an actual discrepancy. You can't get away from the fact that the novel was written, The Princess Bride, and as an answer why she was able to be called princess. But in this, there are discrepancies. So it's an actual discrepancy that Rob Reiner just kind of overlooked.
You know what? I've never cared. I've never questioned it.
Right. Like, there's a few other things that you could nitpick if you really wanted to, but I'm not really interested in nitpicking that much. I figure she's just a princess because he's a prince, and he goes around and he's like, you know, like, oh, I can name whoever I want for my bride, and when I do that, they're officially a princess because royalty makes up all of these like arbitrary rules.
Fine by me.
Yeah.
So she doesn't love him because she's declared that she will never love again, right? But she, the only pleasure she experiences is her daily ride through the countryside.
And it's important to plotters, because the grandfather makes this known, is that Humperdinck knows that she doesn't really care about him. He's just doing this because she's very attractive and wanting a wife. And she's just sort of like, well, my life is over because my beau died.
We find some additional details on why he wants to marry her later. But for now in the plot, that's pretty much all we need to know.
Correct.
We also know that she's alone on these rides, and at which point you see her ride through this, everything's through this beautiful fall landscape in England, probably, and she's in this gorgeous red boot, red tight, red dress, gold belt deal with the hair that I always wanted as a child, like length, wavy, honey golden hair. Like, who doesn't want that? I knew a girl in high school who had that. And I never realized how much work it took to get that done.
As someone who has long hair, you have to brush it at least twice a day.
Yeah, I comb my short hair like once a day, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure I don't eat the right vitamins. I don't know. I don't think I'll ever get there. Like, I might as well just shave it all off.
Naomi.
Yeah.
Your hair is beautiful, just like you.
Oh.
Now back to the movie. Sorry. Okay.
So she hollers up at these three people standing in her path.
And he's like, excuse me, lady, we are but lost circus performers. And I'm laughing on the inside when he says that. But there's a short, bald guy. There's like a medium sized guy with some like pretty epic hair. Uh-huh. And then there's this like giant guy.
She's like, there's nothing around, not for miles.
Well, then no one will hear you when you scream.
Fezzik reaches up, grabs her shoulder, Vulcan neck pinches her, and she goes down.
That's the giant, by the way. This is the short guy, the short bald guy is Vicini. He's played by Wallace Shawn. I don't even have to look at the IMDb because I know this so well. And then the medium-sized guy is Inigo Montoya. This is played by the wonderful Mandy Patinkin.
Mandy!
And then the giant is Fezzik, and he's played by Andre the Giant.
What was his... Okay, who used to... Is this a Lydia fact? He used to be...
He was Andre the Giant is a WWE wrestler. His birth name was Andre Roussimoff. He's from France. And he actually got his start in wrestling in France under the name of Jean Fairy, which is pretty much the giant fairy. And his whole like backstory, because like all WWE is just like, you know, performance. His whole backstory was that he was this giant fairy that went ahead and would chop wood down in the forest. And HBO's got this really nice documentary about him if you're interested.
You know, now, having heard you talk about him, I am interested in the documentary about him because he's just a fantastic and sympathetic person. I've never heard anything bad for as being as large and as intimidating as he was. Like, he's always kind, maybe a little drunk, but like always kind and only aggressive in the ring.
So this is something that Hulk Hogan said about him is, and he also mentioned this about the WWE. He said, this is not a business of tough guys. If you're in this business, it's to entertain. And for those guys that thought they were tough guys in this business, Andre the Giant would straighten them out real quick. So not only was he a bit of a paladin, he was also like, you're not allowed to do this. Don't be a dickhead. Basically, and he would enforce that, and he could because of his size.
Good on you, Andre.
Yeah. So it's kind of sad when you hear about like other stuff that went on and how Vince McMahon is probably just the worst.
I think we should talk about that during Andre's specific scene because it's important and we should talk about it, but there's a more Andre-centric moment. So she gets Vulcan arm pinched off of her horse. Horse is gone. The horses appear and disappear all over in this film. Now they're at a boat. You see Vicini ripping off a piece of fabric. Spaniard's curious, and it helps the exposition along. He's just like, what are you doing? And my Spanish accent is only slightly worse than Mandy Patinkin's. And he's like, it's a material from a uniform of a officer of Gilder, the sworn enemies of Florence across the waters and across the sea. And when they find it on the horse, when the horse goes back to the castle, they'll find it and there'll be irrevocable proof that Gilder did it, and then war will happen. Vicini seems all in on it and like super down, and the other two are like, wait, what?
Yeah, so like Fezzik says, I don't know how I feel about this, about killing an innocent girl. And Fezzik's like, I've hired you to start a war. It's a very prestigious line of work. And what does Inigo come and say? I'm with Fezzik.
Oh, is that what he said?
Yeah.
He goes, I don't feel right killing an innocent girl. Oh. We are in the very prestigious, nationalism killing would be involved.
Yeah. He's like, oh, the Sot has spoken. And that's when Vicini really goes hard in on these two, because they've both kind of challenged his authority in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And Vicini reminds me of like someone who bought a Subway franchise and thinks that they're like hot to trot.
What?
But he really hasn't like done much.
We offer you the $5 footlong and you're telling me that's not added value?
Did I mention that your job is at stake?
You can have as many vegetables as you want on that guy.
Am I going deaf or did the word think come out of your mouth?
He just, literal line.
He like goes in and, you know, starts going in and talking about like, Inigo was supposed, was like, you know, just this, was just this drunk and he didn't have anything until Vicini showed up. And then he goes over to Fezzik and he's just like, jobless, friendless, brainless, hopeless.
Did you want me to send you back to where I found you?
Unemployed in Greenland! I hope they heard that upstairs. What if we didn't tell your mom what movie we were doing? Do you think she'd figure it out?
She would know in a heartbeat.
Because of this movie.
Yes, there's no part where you say something. If you, I've never quoted this movie and had somebody be like, what's that from? Or more often, did you just make that up? And I'm like, no, no, friend, I'm quoting Rocky Horror Picture Show. Or like, no, no, friend, I'm quoting Mylon Otis. Like, I've never spoken the phrase, no, no, I'm quoting Princess Bride.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Unemployed in Greenland.
Yeah.
So now, and you know what? Something that I really enjoy about this book. Nope. Sorry. Do you want to know what I think about this book? Please reference at least Howl's Moving Castle, Never Ending Story. What other book movies have we read?
I think those are the only two. Maybe, I returned to Oz a little bit, but even still, it was more about the movie in that one.
True. Okay. But something I admire about this film is that we have a narrator, we have a listener, we have different plot points happening at the same time. However, as a person who I'm sure you guys, if you've listened to more than one episode of this, know that I have a trouble following these different types of plot points separated by cuts away to different scenes. They don't do that a lot in this film. And so even though there are certain parts I missed as a kid, which I'm sure we'll get into, the linear nature of the progression of scenes is immaculate in this. Like, okay, so she got snatched off her horse. Now they're in the boat. Now they're yelling at each other. And now it's nighttime and they're still in the boat. I haven't had to think about it so much, you know?
We did miss talking about the one moment where Inigo and Fezzik, they kind of like go off to the side a little bit and they start talking about Vizzini. He sure likes to fuss.
I think he likes to talk a lot.
Perhaps he means no harm.
He's very, very short on charm.
And this is a running gag until the end of the scene. And I feel like it just, like, I'm not going to say it because we could. Like I said, you know, my notes could have been surrounding the entire script, and that would be a valid way of taking notes for this movie.
If I had had the time to reread the book, I would be able to exposit again this to you so much more. But they have this Fezzik and Inigo rhyming at each other through the entire book. And it's relegated to this scene, but it shows the rapport between the two. They are the henchmen. They are bonded. They are like the heart that belongs within this team at this very moment.
Right. At the beginning of the scene, they kind of come across as generic bad guys. But like my note was, generic bad guys have personality. Also, this one scene shows characterization for everyone in this scene outside of Buttercup, which considering the fact that two out of the three players come across as like villains.
You are correct when you say that these three quote unquote villains have the most character development in such a short amount of time that you cannot help but love them. Instantly, even the evil one, you're like, yeah, but like his little lisp, his angry little Napoleon complex, you're like Vicini for life right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Despite the fact that he's angry subway manager, he's still like, you know, like if you put me in a room and said you have to kill either Humperdinck or Vicini, I'm going to choose Humperdinck because Vicini, like, he seems like he's the kind of like, I don't think I'm going to be able to do anything with Humperdinck.
Yeah, he's an impossible character we'll rant about in approximately two scenes.
Right.
Okay. So, they're on a boat. Then it gets nighttime? Oh, no more rhymes now, and I mean it.
Anybody want a peanut?
And if you don't know that line, you haven't watched this movie at least once.
Right.
Which is fine, but you need to get on it if you're this far into the podcast.
Yeah. So later it shows it goes from daytime to nighttime. They're going through the water still. And Buttercup is awake and they...
Oh, they refer to Potemkin as the Spaniard a lot, which I don't know. I guess maybe he's exotic, which is a problematic term, but he's probably the only person of color represented in the entire film. But he's looking over the side of the boat. Mm-hmm. Vicini's like, will you quit doing that?
He says that he, what is it? Buttercup says, makes some sort of jab at what they're trying to do and says that they're not going to be able to get away with it. And he said, and Vicini's retort is, of all of the necks on this boat, Your Highness, that you should be worried about, yours. Sorry, he does it a lot better.
The one you should worry about is yours.
Thank you. And Indigo keeps looking over his shoulder behind the back of the boat.
What are you looking at?
He's like, oh, I just looked around and I saw something behind there.
Looked and I didn't see anything there, but then I looked back and then suddenly there's something there.
Yeah.
No one could have followed us. And nobody from Florence has followed us. Nobody from Gilder knows what's going on. And nobody from Florence could have gotten here this fast. You're just being paranoid.
It's inconceivable. This is the first time we hear the line inconceivable. Yeah. And so he just says, well, it looks like there's someone back there. And so Vicini gets up and he goes to the back of the boat and he's like, it's probably just some fishermen swimming at night in eel infested waters. And that's when we hear a sploosh.
Yes.
And then they turn around and they see that Princess Buttercup has just like gotten out of the boat and she's like swimming.
And then, okay, so she's swimming for all she's worth. They're leaning over the side of the boat, and Vicini and Andre Fezzik lean over the side of the boat. You notice something cute about this part?
Yeah, so the boat is actually, like, the back behind them isn't, like, square. It's not, like, parallel with the side that they're on. It's a little bit tilted on the side where they have Andre the Giant, because this is a man, I think at this point he was weighing, like, 500 pounds.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And he was, like, 7 feet tall, so he was pretty muscular, but this was a guy who could, like, lift up a bodybuilder. And I think he did that to Arnold Schwarzenegger once.
Good for him.
Yeah. It's always humbling to see a really big guy get picked up by an even bigger guy.
When he was asked about the favorite thing about making this movie, what it was, he said that it was that nobody looked at him. Like, everybody treated him like just an actor on the stage, not like the way that they probably treated him in the WWE.
Or even like when he was traveling in the documentary, a lot of people mentioned that it was hard for him to really like hide himself. Like when you're famous, if you don't have like a very large body, it can be easy to kind of disguise yourself, but not if you're Andre the Giant because he's so big. And so, yeah, I could see why that would have been great. But I noticed it. Tilt.
Well, they built an actual boat. This is the practical effect that amused me was that since they built a boat and it wasn't very big, think like a trailer, like your average 25-foot, 30-foot trailer size boat. And so if he's in it, in like, you can tell that they kind of moved it probably to one of those big pools on a lot they have where they filmed all the drowning scenes in Titanic. Like, if he's sitting in a boat and he's leaning over these quote unquote, or sorry, swish, swish, eel-infested waters, and Vicini's just like, do you hear that, princess? Do you hear that?
Those are the shrieking eels. They always grow louder before they're about to strike.
And Buttercup is just like, she's swimming, and then you see this eel kind of like swim by her.
He like full on head rams her and then goes around her, and she's like, oh, shit.
Yeah. And then we see an eel come around, and it's like gaining more and more to her. Vicini before this had said to turn around and try and go after her. And so we see the eel coming closer and closer and closer.
Cut.
She does not get eaten by the eels at this time.
And that's the grandfather talking to the grandson. He's just like,
what?
No, he's just like, he's kind of like, Fred Savage is so much the audience in this movie.
He does not get eaten. She does not, he, she, whatever, changes the construct. She does not get eaten by the eels at this time. Okay, can I tell you that I made Lucas watch Evil Dead a few months ago, like in the middle of the summer. And he was like, he started to freak out on me, and I was like, bruh, Ash lives. Ash is the anti-hero. He's the good guy. He's going to be at the end. You don't need to worry about Ash. Everybody else may or may not die. But what you need to remember is that this is a ridiculous film. Everything is over the top. So if you start to feel like worried about something, just know it's going to get a whole lot worse. And by getting a whole lot worse, it's going to get a whole lot funnier. And you need to train yourself in this moment to laugh. Because if you identify with Ash, he's fine, bruh.
Evil Dead 2 was released this year. It released in the same year as Princess Bride as well.
87, you trippy bitch.
Yeah.
We're so thankful you've decided to listen to our crew of humble podcast performers applauded. Thank you for listening to part one of our month-long review of 1987's The Princess Bride. Want to join us in listening to some other fantastic shows? With My Next Pick is a topical podcast with many subjects, and just discuss their favorite Disney characters. And Bigfoot for Breakfast is a research-based entertainment podcast exploring mysteries, and this past week has discussed reptilians. Hey, this is your audio engineer and masked swordsmith of the cutting room floor, Jen. Have you had a chance to rate or review us on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser.com? Doing so helps lift us up in search results, and we'd love to read your review on a future episode of Shock Talk. We'll return with more laughs and quotable lines in 1 week for part two of our review of this cherished romantic fantasy comedy. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.